question.
Popular legislation.
Meeting will please come to order. This is a regular meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, Wednesday, February 6th. Time is 1:20. Members present are myself, Representative Jabbar, Representative Kopnik, Representative Hanley, Representative Pierce, Representative Boucher, and Vice Chair Representative Davis. Has everyone who wishes to testify signed in? If you haven't, there's a sign-up sheet over on that table in the corner. We have three bills and one executive order on our agenda today. Committee substitute for House Bill 62, an act relating to the payment of prevailing wages and the payment of overtime under public construction contracts. Executive Order 60, transferring the Athletic Commission from the Governor's Office to the Department of Commerce. House Bill 123, extending the termination date of the Board of Pharmacy. House Bill 126, an act amending the Alaska Security Act.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure who would be the appropriate person to answer the first question, and I think that would relate probably to a fiscal note that would go along with this bill and what the impact of this bill might actually have on construction using state funds within the state.
Okay. Mr. Bacola, could you?
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note that we submitted was a zero fiscal note. This was based on the fact that, again, I'd like to reiterate, this is nothing more than a housekeeping bill to codify existing interpretations of law. We're already performing this activity, so it's not going to change our needs to increase the staff, or would it increase our resources to any significant degree. We'll still be doing the same activity, so thus we did not submit any fiscal note. We submitted a zero fiscal note.
And that's the Department of Labor.
Yes, ma'am.
It has a zero fiscal note.
Representative Hanley.
Mr. Chairman, my concern is with the first section one, beginning with line 11. Notwithstanding the provisions of Alaska Statute 2310060, and then it cites 17 and 18. And looking up those provisions, the current regulations provide for flex time. And in a conversation that I had this morning with the contract manager at the Anchorage School District, many contractors prefer 4-10s. Many of the companies coming in are working 4-10s. If we no longer can allow for that flex time, it seems to me that many of the projects throughout the state, if anything over 8 hours, you're looking at every week paying 8 hours of overtime. If we no longer can allow a contractor and people who agree to work on a 4-day, 10-hour-day basis, if that's no longer possible under the provisions of House Bill 62, I think we're looking at a great deal of construction monies added to present construction contracts.
I'll wait for a response from the Department of Labor first.
Mr. Chairman, give you a little bit of historical background. Section 17 and 18 come about primarily as a result of lobbying by the banking institutions and the airlines to accommodate their employees who wanted to have more time free with their families. This provides for the type of industry that generally works employees on 8-hour shifts. Under the Title 23, anything over 8 hours is time and a half. That was the primary reason why that this law was enacted, to allow those institutions, if they desired to have their employees work 10-hour days up to a maximum 40 hours a week, they would do so. I might point out that in the construction industry, this has never been allowed, primarily because of the fact that the construction industry, particularly public construction industry, most of your shifts are 7-10s or 7-12s or 6-10s or 6-12s. So obviously this would be a mechanism whereby an employer could circumvent the intent of the law in terms of the overtime compensation for employees.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Department of Labor answered my what I was going to say. Basically, is I think this has to do with public construction. I have some friends that work in 4-10s also, but they're not working construction projects in it. Not been my experience of knowing many construction jobs work only 4 days a week. They usually work in 5 and sometimes 6, and if they're lucky 7, but unless the department has some other information, my understanding is that this is for public construction, which wouldn't limit people working in offices, places like that, to working 4-10s.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Collins.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up to Representative Hanley's comments. On line 20, it states that the pay for all work in excess of 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week. And I think her concern is similar to mine in terms of if you have a construction project, which because of weather doesn't get off the ground, and in that sense, instead of say working 4 hours, people with that additional 4 hours that was missed would have to be paid a time and a half if it were done the next day. And by deleting the 8-hour requirement, it would allow for people to be paid overtime if they really needed it and would leave some flexibility in there. And I think that's kind of what she's talking about.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I quite understood your...
If there's a situation in which an employer, or particularly in construction, puts in, say, just 4 hours a day, right, because of weather or because supplies didn't come, and those 4 hours have to be made up the next day. Instead of letting people go and have half the day, then having them come back and work, say, 12 hours the next day, or adjusting for that time later at a regular rate, this would require that all that time be adjusted at time and a half.
No, I don't think so. If they only work 4 hours a day, well, that's 4 hours a day. The only time that overtime comes into play if they work in excess of 8 hours a day or 40 hours in a week. I've never heard of too many construction projects where they only work 4 hours a day. And they generally work in all kinds of inclement weather conditions and what have you. It's very rarely that you'll find that construction doesn't go on even in the dead of winter. So that might be true in some industries, but certainly not in the construction industry.
Thank you. At this time, I'd just like to note presence of Representative Furness, welcome. Representative Hanley.
Mr. Chairman, I think that I still need to have something clarified. It seemed to me in the conversation that I had this morning with the capital projects manager of the school district, he was talking about construction. He's talking about school construction. He was talking about contractors who often or have on occasion have had two crews working 240-hour shifts, two crews each working 410s, not obligated to pay overtime, working a 40-hour week. And I guess the second example I think of is what the project that's coming up. I'm not sure what the arrangements will be. I know the wages will be Davis-Bacon as being contracted or perhaps has been contracted or bid through the Anchorage School District, and that's the asbestos removal at Bartlett High School. To get that project done in the number of days that are allowed is going to require, I'm not sure how many crews, if they're basing it on a 40-hour work week and using different crews, we might be looking at something altogether different as far as the price from what would have to be paid under this, if anything over 8 hours a day. I have no complaints with the 40 hours a week. Anything over 40 hours a week is overtime. No, and I'm not complaining about the little Davis-Bacon wage scale, but I am concerned about the anything over 8 hours a day. If you've got people working 410s, then you've got 8 hours in that week that are going to be overtime that would not be in a 410 situation.
Mr. Chairman, I might mention, regardless of whether it was covered by the state statutes or not, the federal law would require that overtime be paid in excess of 8 hours.
Would that be even under existing law with the 2310-060-1 to 17 and 18 if the employees had agreed and signed a written agreement agreeing to flex time?
I don't have an answer to that. Perhaps I might refer that to my Deputy Director, Don Wilson, who is in the audience. Perhaps he could answer that question, if it's the desire of the committee.
Yeah. If you can answer the question,
can I do it from here?
Sure.
It's like space facility. If I'm Don Wilson, Deputy Director of Labor Standards and Safety, would you pose the question again so I do?
My concern has been that if a company were working employees 410s, 4 days, 10 hours a day, a total of 40 hours a week, would they be obligated to pay overtime?
Under
testimony has been that federal law requires anything over 8 hours.
Right. First of all, you're talking about, you've got two separate laws in discussion here, all right? Two state laws, of which there are two federal counterparts, right? Now, the federal has what they call the Fair Labor Standards Act, which applies in broad terms to any employment, retail, whatever it might be, which is the same as state's wage and hour act. Under the federal law, overtime is paid under the Fair Labor Standards Act only for work over 40 hours a week. Under the state act, it's paid over 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week unless a voluntary flexible work overtime is in effect. But under the state and federal law, both applying to public construction contracts, the overtime work scheme is 8 and 4 under both.
And do I understand you to say that the present statutes allow under Title 23 and these Sections 17 and 18 that if an agreement has been registered or has been, if the employees agree to a 40-hour week, which is made up of 410s, that is at the present time allowed and doesn't require overtime? Under existing state law.
Under existing state law, if it's not public. Yes, under existing state law, the only overtime provision that we currently have is that found in Title 23. You see, when our founding fathers enacted our Little Davis-Bacon Act, they modeled it 100% after the federal act. except they didn't look at the federal enabling legislation. The federal act gets its overtime from three separate acts, which we have no counterpart in the state. So the only overtime act we have is under 1023. What we're attempting to do, since we don't have the enabling legislation that the federal government has, we're trying to bring it into the act, because our act is modeled after the federal act, and the intent is overtime, over 80, and over 40.
That answers my question. Yeah, I understand that's what we're trying to do. Are we under pressure by the federal government to do that?
No, we're not under pressure by the federal government to do anything. We're trying to make the law clear to everyone. It's been a very difficult thing to administer. As we said, in some cases, set up rather unfair competitive systems, since labor is a very competitive thing within these construction acts. And most of us housekeeping legislation, following the dictates of the advisement of our own attorney general, as well as what the court has told us in the Sitka matter, in the modeling of our law. And this is why I think Mr. Nicholas addresses housekeeping legislation. It's not new.
Thank you.
Representative Pierce.
Thank you. I guess I want somebody to reiterate what I think they just said. If the Anchorage School District and people who contract to do the asbestos removal there need to use, for whatever reasons, because they have to scrunch all this asbestos removal into a short time span, and they need to figure out how to do their shifts so that they can do that, and they wanted to use 4/10s as flex time, am I correct that they cannot do that?
Can they do that now under existing law?
They can't do it now.
Yes.
They can't do it now because we don't have a state law. We have to look to the federal law for the hours of work. And so what this bill is basically doing is, instead of looking to the federal law, it would all be set out in our law.
Okay. They can't do it now, and they can't do it under this bill either. So there's no cost, no added cost. Thank you.
Correct.
Are there any further questions?
I have some further questions, but I'm wondering if we have people who are going to testify, maybe my questions would be answered and I wouldn't have to ask them.
I have only one other person to testify. Mr. Becker?
Becker.
He's the only other one I have to testify. Not hear his testimony or were your questions for Mr. Bacolas?
Well, my questions are for somebody because I have a number of questions on the bill. And so it's
okay.
Your pleasure to let you
want
me to do
the now or later. How about, I would just as soon do your testimony and then we'll call whoever's needed to hopefully answer the questions. Mr. Becker?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Becker. I'm representing the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. I serve in the capacity as Vice President of Public Policy for that organization. The Alaska Support Industry Alliance is an organization of some 200 companies which provide equipment, supplies, and services to the state's oil, gas, and mining industries. I appear before the committee very spontaneously. Unfortunately, yesterday was the first day that I've had the opportunity to be in Juneau this year. I reviewed yesterday the bills which were introduced and had a number of them pulled, which are of concern, in my judgment, to the members of the committee. This bill happened to be one of those which I had pulled. I honestly can't tell you if there's anyone who is a member of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance today if there's going to be any particular concern. But there is enough concern that I hear at this table, and also I know it's a, you know, a housekeeping measure, but in one instance, for example, the civil penalties are jumping from $1,000 to $25,000. That's going to get attention of somebody. Whether, you know, I'm not saying that our members violate this and would be burdened by something like this, but at least I'm wondering if it'd be possible that the committee might delay reporting out of this particular bill until such time as that we might be able to get back to you with a prepared remarks. Our public policy committee meets Friday, and I would present it and bring it up for discussion at that time. That's the only observation I have.
Mr. Becker, there are several other committees of referral. If I'm comfortable with the questions that we have today, that they're answered, you can address that point at a next committee of referral. I don't know whether we'll hold this bill over or not. It all depends on whether myself and the committee are satisfied today. But I thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
And I have a series of questions.
For
I guess probably Mr. Bacolus might be the best person to vote.
Yeah. Mr. Bacolus?
Thank you, and I ask the committee's patience as I went through this bill. A number of questions arose, and I bring this information up not so much as a challenge, but really for purposes of information. I do have a question in going back to the flex time again. Somewhere in all the volumes of information that I've read, there was an indication that in order to develop, for example, mining, that we're going to have to be looking at some flex time provisions, and it was my understanding that there was a concern that presently that's going to be a problem, and so I thought in this time when we might need to develop our other natural resources than we have in areas such as mining, which might require some flex time provisions, that this might present a problem to it, and maybe you can just rest my mind on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Collins, I think what you're talking about is a fluctuating work week plan, which isn't the same as a flex plan. And I know the Department of Labor has had several meetings with industry with regards to the proposed legislation for a fluctuating work week. That should probably come up again in the very near future, which will address those type of industries that that type of plan would be acceptable in. And that's really not a flex plan.
So that wouldn't be affected by this. The other question I have is on page 2, line 2. It talks about if there's a change, and it really substitutes some new language in there, and it talks about adopting regulations rather than promulgating them. And my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's a difference in the language in that. To promulgate some regulations requires that you have public hearings, public testimony, and go through a process. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that means that the department then would have the ability to adopt any regulations they saw fit without getting public input on it. Is that correct?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
If I understand it correctly, this was just some housekeeping language changes recommended by the Attorney General's office. To adopt regulations is to adopt them subsequent to the public hearing process and the proper noticing requirements reviewed by the Attorney General's office. That doesn't change at all. We still have to do that. We can't just arbitrarily adopt regulations without public hearings and input from industry, labor, the general public, etc.
Because you're saying adopt and promulgate are the same thing. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. The next question that I had was on line 8, and it repeals an entire section AS 3605060, and it's reenacted to read, and this has to do with the penalties that Mr. Becker addressed. And I noticed in looking up the section that it significantly does raise the penalties for up to $25,000, and I believe in the previous section there was a limit, and it does so again, in section B. And I'm concerned about that because that's a significant jump, and I wondered what the justification was for that jump in penalties.
Again, this is only a recommendation of the Attorney General's office. Under the current law, we've had experienced problems in the way the language is written. I think it provides that if a contractor's in violation of the chapter, that it constitutes a misdemeanor, which means then you have to go to the district attorney's office to seek prosecution. Obviously, that's not one of the most burning issues of our time as far as the district attorney goes. So the Attorney General recommended that rather than do it this way, that we could go into court, de novo, and I think this is in conjunction with other provisions in the bill that allow us to request the Attorney General to go into court and seek either money damages, injunctive relief, restraining orders, a variety of different remedies that might be available to the department. All this does is actually take away the high standard of proof required in a criminal investigation and give us some leeway without having to go to the district attorney's office to seek prosecution. We've never actually prosecuted under this particular section because it was just simply too cumbersome. And it was extremely difficult. And that's one of the reasons it was never pursued. But this allows us to handle the cases more expeditiously as well. And as far as the penalty, I don't think that's at all too high. I think if somebody is in violation of the law, that perhaps if you you make the penalty high enough, it'll wake them up to reality. Perhaps.
Well, it doesn't seem too high if you don't have to pay it. You know, if you pay it out of your pocket, it seems sure. Kind of high. The other question I had was on, and I do think that's a real problem of related concern of mine. The other one that I have some real concerns about is if you look at section, we're looking on page 3, and if you look at it from line 9 through, say, 13, and again, line 20 to 28, and it makes me really nervous because it seems like a real policing action by the state. And I guess I feel uncomfortable about that, and I'm concerned that that's really necessary.
Well, we're in the business of enforcement of labor laws, and if a contractor is in violation of the act, mm-hmm. There's provision, as you know, in the current law that provides that if the contractor is in violation and he refuses to come into compliance, we have the remedy of going to the contracting agency and have him retain so much of the funds that would be due the employees mm-hmm. on a prevailing wage rate deficiency. So I don't see where that's really a problem. If the contractor is in violation of the law and just refuses to comply with the law, then at least we have a mechanism whereby we can go to the contracting agency, retain those funds. Because the real intent of the law here is to protect the wage earner. It's, as I mentioned in a previous committee meeting, that in Labor's 942 versus SECA, the Supreme Court ruled that the intent of the law was for the benefit of the employees, not the contracting agencies. So I think you have to have some way to assure these employees that if an employer doesn't comply with the law, he's at least going to have an opportunity to get those funds. Because once the job is completed and that guy is gone and needs to strip those monies, it's going to be extremely difficult to obtain that money from the contracting agencies once it's been released.
I guess my concern is I can understand protecting the workers' rights, and I certainly support that, but I also have a concern that in protecting somebody's rights that we don't violate somebody else's. And that was my concern about this. On line 12, where it says that the shall withhold so much of the accrued payments due the contractor as is necessary to pay laborers. Is there a time frame there? How long is this going to be held? 60 days, 90 days, 8 years?
I don't think there's any particular time frame to my knowledge. I can check that out further for you. We notify the contracting agency to retain those funds. And then once that they have dispersed those funds to the employees entitled to those wages, then we release that particular retainage request. Then they go ahead and distribute the balances to the contractor.
But there's nothing here to make sure that the contractor gets his money back when he really deserves it, or get it back.
Sure, if he deserves the money, he's going to get it. But if he's not paid his employees the prevailing wage rate, those are going to be deducted from that amount.
I guess the concern that I have is that if this were brought up, you know, to to the department, and all the information wasn't there, that this could be invoked and the money held back, and could create a problem, say, during just investigation of the thing. And that's my concern, if it takes, and then I'm thinking, is what if you hold the money back for 6 months, and it turns out that nothing really was there, and in the meantime, this contractor's been out $5 or $6 million, and he's gone broke.
Excuse me, Representative Collins, that is already included in the law also.
Well, I think you're talking about the section below that for 3 years. Is that what you're referring to?
No, that's not being amended. If they're notified by the department now, the contracting agent withholds those funds until they determine whether or not there was a violation. They do that now. I had a question about that too. I think the borough, Kena Peninsula Borough, is involved in litigation on that. And I asked you about that. Because it's under law, I'm a little concerned about a time frame too. How long does it take in order to resolve the complaints?
Well, that depends. On a lot of times, if you find an employer that's in violation of the law, and there's a prevailing wage rate deficiency, in a great deal of the cases, they'll come into immediate compliance once we commence our enforcement action. Others that actually ignore it, and we have to seek retainage funds, those are the ones you have the problem with. Just off the top of my head, I wouldn't be able to give you an answer as to how long it takes to do that. I might ask Mr. Wilson, who would be able to respond to the question.
This was a concern of the Attorney General a long time ago, and it was even more of a concern in the last session when the law was enacted that provided the 10% interest available to contractors in certain cases. We have a mechanism set up that gives due process. When we find a contractor that's in violation, we find this either as a result that they refuse to submit certified payrolls, we have a complaint, or in auditing their payrolls, we find the deficiencies. We immediately go to the contractor and ask them to come in and pay, to make it correct. It's a very standard form letter that goes out. It's when the contractor refuses to meet his obligation, refuses to submit those payrolls required by law, refuses to comply with the results of an audit, we then go out to the contracting agency and say, please retain this much money that we have determined by audit to be due. We also notify the contracting agents, the contractor, the contracting agency, as well as the prime contractor on the job, because the prime contractor sureties that are in jeopardy. We immediately then go out with subpoenas and bring that contractor in and conduct a hearing to determine the facts of the situation. Based on that hearing, based on those facts, we get the dispersal and even possibly refer to the Attorney General for further action. But retainage is not that common. We do it, but not that commonly, because most people are willing to come in compliant. So we have the system set up to give due process, give hearing, and be defended by counsel the entire 9 yards.
Thank you.
And it's all established for everything.
Thank you.
I'm not through with my questions. And the other question I have too, and maybe I just haven't seen in the bill, is there a time, like a statute of limitations on this, so that if somebody comes back, say 2 years after they've been on a job, and they say, I just realized that I wasn't paid, and Alaska now has this law, is there anything there that will provide some time where this might be done, or is the contractor going to be at risk, you know, for years and having somebody bring that back?
No, as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's a 2-year statute of limitations.
There's a 2-year statute of limitations.
Wage claims.
Okay, and then thank you. And then I have another question on page 4. The section on apprentices, and it's lines, I believe, 1 through 9. And it says, an employee listed on a payroll as an at an apprentice wage rate who is not in a registered apprenticeship program must be paid at the minimum prevailing wage rate for that work classification. I'm aware that there are several programs, some are federal, some are state programs that are on the job training programs, and they come under a variety of names, which this would affect on any public contract. The concern is that these people usually are people who are disadvantaged or are physically handicapped or have a physical disability, and specifically state and federal law says that if any state or federal dollars are being used, that they have preferential hire. And many times, specifically in working with injured workers, the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation and private rehabilitation people utilize such programs at a lower wage, and they are implemented in public and federal contracts, and this would prevent that from happening, according to my interpretation here. I also know that other companies, because of my involvement in the job market, do take people on in a helper capacity and pay them to break them in and you know, get them up to, say, a higher wage at a later rate, and that would not allow those companies to do that. And I guess my concern is that on the one hand, I see how it might make sure that somebody gets paid the right wage, but on the other hand, there's a whole section, a lot of people out there that are going to be adversely affected. And I checked that with the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation this morning, and they did confirm that, in fact, this would be a problem.
Of course, the apprenticeship program has to be an approved program from the U.S. Department of Labor, the Commission of Labor. I think probably one of your concerns is that if they're not in a registered program, that they would have to be paid at the journeyman level. Is that correct?
Pardon?
They would have to be paid at the journeyman level.
No.
That wasn't your concern?
No. Well, my concern is that, it's my understanding, the way this is written, that people on public contracts are going to have to be paid at the prevailing rate, right?
Right.
All right. And so apprenticeship to me means a lot of things, and maybe that's not addressed in this issue, but I think that that section brings in some of those people I was talking about. When those people are brought onto those projects, they are very often brought in, because they are in a training situation, brought in at a lower rate, and that they would not be able to do this on a public contract if this exists.
Well, your apprenticeship rate is lower than your journeyman rate, obviously. And I'm sure that there's a number of handicapped or disadvantaged people that are involved in apprenticeship programs. Mm-hmm. I don't have a number for you. I think just because you're handicapped doesn't preclude you from being an apprentice.
Well,
I really don't think so.
Well, I think that some of those apprentice programs, you know, have some limitations for age, don't they? So if you're over a certain age, you can't enter?
I don't think so.
I think if you talk to some of the unions, they might have some restrictions in terms of who can become an apprentice.
Of course, I can't speak on behalf of the unions, but I think we have some very strict federal laws and state laws that would take a dim view of somebody discriminating against somebody because of age, mm-hmm. or race, or sex, or whatever. But no, I don't think that would be in any apprenticeship program, because the legal counsel that review these apprenticeship training programs would certainly address the problem of age, sex, or race discrimination.
Representative Collins, are you
just about finished? Yep.
Are you referring maybe to some special programs? Then I think under this definition of apprenticeship that they would not be included unless they were simply on the payroll as an apprentice. Say something. I mean, there. It seems like rather than put them on as an apprentice, put them on under a special program, and I think that would probably be allowed. I think what this is attempting to do is prevent the contractor from paying at a lower wage scale by putting them on as an apprentice rather than as a journeyman. I don't think it would apply to a special program, which I think.
But exactly, those programs are apprentice programs. That's what I'm telling you. They're maybe not used in the context that they're used, say, in a union setting where somebody's an apprentice and then somebody's a journeyman. But that word is used, and it would affect those people. And as I said, I discussed that with the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation this morning, and they did indicate that would be a problem to them. And again, it's a problem because Alaska state law says that, you know, we have to have these programs available on public projects. And that's why I raised the question.
I don't believe that they call employees employed in sub-minimum wage programs, apprentices. They're work therapy type programs. I know Mr. Wilson has most recently developed a unit within the Wage and Hour Administration to oversee and monitor work therapy programs like the Keela House and some of those, including sub-minimum wage programs that provide the type of training that you're referring to. That should not be confused with an apprenticeship program, which requires extensive training and education in whatever craft that they may be involved in. That could be as much as 4 years. Some of it's based on hours. So an electrician, of course, or a carpenter or a plumber would probably have to undergo at least a year of apprenticeship training before they would be eligible to be considered as trainee or a helper for eventually become a journeyman plumber, electrician, carpenter. I don't have any data on exactly what those requirements are, but certainly don't confuse those sub-minimum programs with an apprenticeship program. They're entirely two different.
Well, I guess I would like that made a little bit clearer in the wording so that it would allow people to continue to do that, because I do know, I have specifically put some of those programs together. I have specifically called them apprenticeship programs, and I would be concerned that I would be prevented from putting one of those programs together for someone because of the word that is used. So if something were put in there to clarify that, make it a little bit more clearer, that would make me a lot more comfortable.
If I'm not mistaken, Representative Collins, that's already included in Title 23. I think this provision for sub-minimum wage work therapy programs. And as I say, we work very closely with these different organizations that have these types of programs, and we monitor them, and we also certify that program as to be eligible for the sub-minimum wage type programs, whether it's substance abuse or alcoholism or whatever it might be, or handicapped person. But we'd be more than happy to provide that information to you.
I would appreciate it.
Sure.
Because the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation doesn't have it.
Okay.
And I would like
to. I'll ask my staff to get together with you later on and provide you with all the information that we feel you be necessary for to satisfy your concerns.
Okay.
Representative Davis.
Yes.
I think he's going to address that.
Okay, I just wanted to, for the committee's information, there's several things that came up in Representative Collins' questions. One has to do with mining, and I believe there is an exemption here under CS 2310055 under exemptions that includes mining, and also under exemption. AS 2310071, as you said, Mr. Proposed, that there is, for work therapy, it does say that there's can be paid less than minimum wage. I'd be glad to share that with
okay.
you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Collins.
Right. Then I have one more question, and that is, looking still on page 4, I think it's one more question. I see why I ask you to be patient, right?
That's okay. That's what I'm here for.
Okay, it's talking about the starting on barring contract violators. And in reading from section, from line 11 down to 29, would you clarify for me how this would occur? And I guess what I'm seeing is that, would it be possible for somebody to be barred to the degree that they couldn't, they could no longer do business in the state of Alaska for having violated?
Representative Collins, this particular section is to deal with flagrant law violators that are set out with the willful intent to violate the law and just totally disregard their obligations under the law. There's a maximum of 3 years that they can be disbarred under this particular provision. I might point out, however, that any disbarment proceedings would be under the Administrative Procedures Act. They'd have a right to a fair and impartial hearing, which also guarantees them due process of the law. That isn't currently in the law, as I recall, the provision for due process under the Administrative Procedures Act. And more importantly, it expedites the process. You don't have to go into court and take forever. The Administrative Procedure Act would certainly hurry things along in that regard.
Representative Collins, that also applies to public construction contracts. so that they wouldn't be barred from doing business in the state. It's simply a penalty on public construction.
Okay, and then the other question I had is on page 5. And starting under line 7, it states that the Attorney General may enjoin a person found in violation of this chapter from continuing to work on an existing public construction contract, impose a civil penalty, and then... And I have a problem with that because it would seem to me that there should be some mechanism there to somewhat limit that a little bit, or to put some limitation like a percentage or something. My thought is if you start a construction project and then you have to stop in the middle of it and then somebody else has to do it, it's going to take a lot longer than if that person were allowed to finish it anyway by the time you get a new contractor, a new crew. And it seems to me that I can understand what you're trying to do in terms of making the contractor bear or share the burden, but I'm just thinking that it would just might be more than anybody could handle, realistically.
Well, if they didn't violate the law, they wouldn't have to worry about it. That's what we call it. So, my thinking is that if they're flagrant law violators and they're not complying with the law, they just totally disregard their obligation. And the political subdivision or whoever is involved has to undertake that project. Certainly, they should be penalized. And this gives them the opportunity to go after their sureties and take whatever action necessary to complete that project. I'm sure that if a contractor undertakes a project and he totally disregards his duties and obligations under that contract, and it becomes necessary for the public entity to remove him and hire another one to complete the job, without some protection, it's going to cost double. It's going to be more a cost to the government by not holding that original contractor responsible for his screw up, so to speak.
Have you ever seen a situation in which a disgruntled employee tried to go after his employer because he wasn't happy about it? Have you ever seen those situations?
Yes, ma'am. Okay.
And I guess that's what I'm concerned about, is that I would expect that might occur. And in looking at this legislation, that's always a possibility. I don't know how often it happens. I think if somebody's flagrantly violated the law, yes, I don't have a problem with it. But I think there are some circumstances where someone has not violated the law, and somebody who's disgruntled and unhappy comes back and wants to rattle some cages. And in the meantime, 6 or 8 months later, you find out the contractor was really okay. But in the meantime, he's been destroyed.
Excuse, he probably has no reason. Excuse me, Representative Collins. I believe they addressed that earlier when they defined what their process is. They do a audit. They don't simply take the complaining employee's word. They go in and do an extensive audit. This is not a first approach. It's a last-ditch approach to a violator. I mean, this is not something that they would just enjoin him from working on a public contract simply because they received a complaint. They would go through the process, including their audit and due process that they offer under the Administrative Act.
My concern, I realize that my concern is raised by my exposure to the Workers' Compensation Department, which is under the Department of Labor. And I know that the way that department works, or their premise, is that if there is a dispute between, say, the employer and the employee, they are obligated to view in the situation in favor of the employee, and the employer then has to prove that is wrong. And if that's the same premise, throughout the Department of Labor, then I have concern about that.
Well, let me clear the air a little bit. I can't answer for the Workers' Compensation Division, but I can tell you that the Labor Standards and Safety Investigators are professionals. They're thoroughly trained. They're fair and impartial. Sure, you get a certain amount of employees that are disgruntled at an employer, and they're going to come in and complain. That's why we have professional investigators to sort out the wheat from the chaff and make those determinations. And what you see here is a last resort, as Chairman Navarre mentioned. When you're talking about flagrant law violators, I might give you an example. Say, for example, if you have an employer on a contract that just simply didn't pay his employees at all, or just refused to pay him, or he got in a financial bind, and your employees are hanging out there for 2-3 weeks and getting no pay, and he makes no real effort to do anything about it. Those are the type of people that you want to remove from those projects. Because if a person is offering his services and his labor to perform work on a public construction project, he's certainly entitled to those wages. And if that's the type of contractor we're dealing with, then we want to get rid of him.
Ms. Plate, you had a comment.
Yes, I was going to say, with regard to the specific section that you're looking at, Representative Collins, that is an action that would be pursued through the court.
I see.
Not by just something that the Department of Labor would do.
Thank you. I believe that is it.
Thank you very much.
I just wanted to point, if I could, Mr. Chairman, that permissible too. It's a may, it's not a shall, so it's not automatically kicked into gear. There's some discretion there, so that may. I just want to point that out in case someone did notice that.
Representative Collins, did you have any further questions?
No, I'm finished. Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions? I might just point out that it's impossible for this legislative body or any legislative body to write a law that would define everything to cover all the details that will come up, because it's just impossible. You have to leave some discretion to the department and the courts. That's why we have courts. Representative Hanna.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm just looking again at the analysis of Section 1 that we have here, and it says the Department of Labor would like to eliminate three of the exemptions. Number one was dealing with employers employing fewer than 4 employees, and 17 and 18 are dealing with flexible wages. So that, I guess that's the same point. We do currently have the a provision that allows flexible wages, and the current law provides for that. And I guess I'm asking, is it the belief of this committee that we're not going to be raising the cost of public construction projects by taking that out?
I need to see Title 23 again, if I could.
Yeah, 23-10-060 are three of the, under Title 23, where being asked to eliminate three exemptions.
I believe that was answered earlier. The problem is with the federal statute, which would.
Yes, what this is basically is doing is, under 2310, those exemptions are applicable. Right now, today, we look to the federal law for enforcement on public construction, which does not permit those kinds of things that those exemptions are for. So what we were trying to do was to set out in the law, so everybody could see what the rules were, those things. So it's not really an elimination of those things. That's a misleading thing, because the way it is right now today is the way the bill is drafted. That's the way it is. It's just setting those things out in Alaska's law instead of Alaska looking to the federal law for those provisions.
Alaska can exempt private employers in these, provide these 18 exemptions for private employers, but we cannot supersede the federal act, which is in force today. The provision here is essentially a statement of the federal act, so that it's clear, which only applies to publicly funded construction, whether it's state or federal. So it's a repetition of the federal act in this case. We do have exemption, but it applies for private employers, the mining industry, the seamen and the like, and the people engaged in the various industries. But we can't
supersede federal law.
And we're just, the attempt of the department is to state federal law in the state statute so that it's clear. Because it has led to difficulties with employers. I know in Fairbanks it led to difficulties on some of these more contractors who went by the state code and then found themselves by the federal guard in that regard. In essence, it is a protection for a contractor, not an attempt. It's so they won't think that they're, won't undertake actions which are federally illegal, because they think they're protected by the state. The state cannot intercede in this case.
At least we haven't found a way yet.
Just a question perhaps of Representative Copeland. A public construction project, then, definition of a public construction project would be any project that uses what amount of state money? If a local district put up $10 million for an elementary school and used $2 million of the state's money, that would be a public construction project. Any amount of money that is given to that district by the state would then make it a public. Anytime state money is used.
But it wouldn't apply, for example, to private school.
Perhaps this firm that you're talking about may be in violation of federal law. Possibly. I don't even know about it.
One other question. Does federal law require that the state have the Little Davis Bacon Act?
No, I think that we had to address that with the state law. Are there any further questions? Some of the questions that have been brought out are legal questions. This bill has a referral to judiciary, and I hope at that time they will be able to address some of the questions that we have. Representative Copeland.
In view of the 120-day limit, I would like to move that we send this bill out with individual recommendations.
Any objections?
HB 62.
And
familiar with this thing, reasonably so.
To just call the meeting back to order, I believe the next item we'll take up on our agenda is the House Bill number 23. 123. House Bill 123. An act extending the termination date for the Board of Pharmacy and providing for an effective date. And the first witness we have will be Mr. Harry Traver from the Department of Commerce, Occupational Licensing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Harry Traver. I'm the Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing. The Division and Administration would support the passage of House Bill 123 for the continuation of the Board of Pharmacy. Our position is that they have functioned in the interest of the public. The legislation that was vetoed last year contained a provision for an executive officer position, which the administration disagreed with. The sunset audit done by legislative audit did also concur in the continuation of the Board of Pharmacy.
Representative Belcher.
I have some questions that weren't covered in this, and this is from talking to some people that are in the industry. Obviously, the Board of Pharmacy has in-depth awareness of the drug problems that we have in the state, and they're looked upon to be assistance of the state. Am I not correct on that? Probably not immediately in your area.
I would have to say that's correct.
Yeah, okay. So we're dealing with also a board that by its very nature has a larger responsibility than it would see as the framework. Have I explained myself? Boards, they are generally looked upon to provide advice in areas by law enforcement and by other people in dealing with drug problems in the state. Would that not be correct?
I know they were consulting to a couple of the board members, not as a board as a whole, but a couple of board members were consulted in the development of the Controlled Substance Act of 1980. Mm-hmm. So the answer would be yes to your question.
Hey, this is some of the feedback that I've been getting on the other half of this information, so to speak, which wasn't covered in here, was number one, they had initially been asked to look at some of the drug problems within the state of Alaska. And this is the reason for the funding. Initially, $50,000 was all that they had asked. And then, in order to love this thing to death, it was kicked up ultimately to $150,000, which made the bill totally impossible for it to pass. And the indications were that the reason the governor said that he vetoed it was because the fiscal note had been lost. Is that correct?
Been lost?
Lost.
I am repeating
some information that was conveyed to me by one of the former members of the board and has been here.
I don't have any knowledge of that, sir.
Do you support the continuation of this board?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask you what you consider as their function. I mean, what is the scope of their responsibilities?
Mr. Chairman, the scope of their responsibility would be to evaluate and judge the competency and qualifications of those practitioners desiring to become pharmacists in the state of Alaska. Their function would be to analyze the application of facilities that want to put pharmacists or drug facilities within it, such as a hospital or a nursing home facility.
Okay. And the bill that was introduced last year for the inclusion of the executive secretary, did you feel that that was unnecessary within the scope of what their responsibilities as a board?
Yes, sir.
And is that already, in your view, covered by the administration and in the Department of Occupational Licensing?
Yes, sir.
Are there any further questions, Mr. Traeger? Okay, thank you, Mr. Traeger, and we will stick around.
Yes, sir, I will.
I'm sure there will be some questions. Representative Furness, testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Representative Furness, and I'd like to provide a little background on this piece of legislation. If you will check the record, it appears that you probably have not had a chance to talk to members of the Pharmacy Board. One of the chief concerns that they had last year that we dealt with was a realization that based upon documented facts, Alaska imports in the highest amount of cocaine than any other state in the union. And, when you compare that with California or New York or whatever, legitimately, Alaska brings in more cocaine than any of these states. One of the requests that the Board of Pharmacy had was to bring on an exec director, and one of their responsibilities was to inventory the, I forget the name of the slips, but a person in order to get a controlled substance must sign for that. They can get any amount that they want, but they must sign for it, and they are assigned a number. One of the responsibilities of this exec director was to catalog who was getting what and where that drug was going. As well known, we have a tremendous problem in this state with illegal use of controlled substance. In my opinion, and in the opinion of the Board of Pharmacy, at least last year, I've not had a chance to confer with the members this year, is a very serious concern. And I think this committee owes it to the general public to give that request of an exec director your support. I know there's been some concern over the cost. I think you'll find the community that this board serves and those persons who are authorized to bring in controlled substance, be they physicians, dentists, veterinarians, in some cases nurse practitioners, particularly in rural settings, I think you'll find these people willing to absorb the cost of this position by an increase in their fees. So, in my opinion, the fact that it's going to cost additional money, so it's going to cost between $40,000 and $50,000 in salary, not to include benefits. You as a committee owe it to the public to look at that very seriously and not simply act upon this bill without giving that some due consideration. I would suggest you hold a public hearing on this, go to teleconference, and give the pharmacies around the state an opportunity to share with you their concern and the magnitude of the problem. This bill, as it is now, in my opinion, is not complete. You need to do that.
Thank you, Representative Prince. Representative Davis?
Yes, thank you. Representative Furness, the reason why this bill sunk last time was because that was tacked on and it was on the House floor, and I think the committee on is certainly interested in seeing this Board of Pharmacy continue, but I don't think this committee wants to put something on that will result in a veto of the legislation, and so I think that's a concern of mine. I haven't had anybody contacting me saying we'll agree to increase the fees and pay for this additional staff. No one's contacted me on that. I understand the problem. I appreciate you coming to tell us about that. But my main concern is making sure this legislation passes both houses and gets signed by the governor. And so that's where I'm coming from on this piece of legislation.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond. The responsibility of the legislature is to pass legislation. I would share with this committee that this bill did pass both House and Senate last year. The legislature is not responsible for the action of the governor in vetoing the bill. This body passed this bill, the Senate passed this bill, and I would think you'd want to put it back on the governor's desk one more time. I would again suggest you contact, I believe the gentleman here is chairman of the Board of Pharmacy. Have you talked to him? Have you called your pharmacists from the city of Fairbanks, and what do they say? Go to public hearing and hear for yourself. You're escaping your responsibility by passing this on with those friendly excuses.
Representative Davis.
Thank you. I did talk to the person in Fairbanks who's on the Board of Pharmacy, and he indicated the desire to have this bill be passed by the legislature, not to tack anything onto it. I haven't heard anything from anyone wanting to add back in anything to the piece of legislation. If that's the concern of the Board of Pharmacy, they haven't contacted me. Maybe perhaps they've contacted other members of the committee. I appreciate you bringing that to us, but if that's what they want, and they want the fees increased to include that, then I would think they would be telling us that before it's before us for passage.
Representative Furness, I've also been in contact with pharmacists in my area, and that corporal is going to testify today. I'd also like to relate to you on behalf of, I think, all the committee members that we are well aware of what our responsibilities are.
Well, I certainly hope, Mr. Chairman, that you would follow. Now, be mindful that the Board of Pharmacy should not bear the total responsibility of this exec director. You've got the Board of Medical Examiners, you've got the Board of, I believe, Veterinarians, you got the Board of Dentistry, and you got the Board of Nursery. Those costs should be spread equally over those various boards because they are the practitioners that legitimately can secure a controlled substance. And one of the responsibilities of the exec director would be to inventory those and keep track and make a report as to who and what and why and where those substances are going. And I think if you do that, then you have indeed addressed your responsibility.
Thank you, Representative Copeland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank Representative Furness for a good succinct statement of the problem that we saw in Labor and Commerce last year in the committee where we met this problem with the bill that we crafted last year. I worked with and voted with Representative Furness on the original bill, and I would still like to see it achieved. But precisely because of your last point, the fact that it affects other professions, I think it has to be severed from the sunset review date and looked at as an overall problem, and that probably we should continue to address it and try to craft legislation in this session that addresses that overall problem of inventory and control of drugs by the various professions that handle them. We can't, as you say, stick the pharmacist with the whole job and the whole cost. So I did also call up members of the board and individual pharmacists, and that was the advice I got from them too. And I'm sorry that we don't have a teleconference. I'm sure that at least from our area that would be the message we would hear.
Mr. Chairman, let me share here. I believe that the Department of Commerce under Mr. Traeger has in some instances an ability by regulation to change the fees charged to various boards and commissions. That does not seem to be a legitimate reason as to not to support an exec director. Time will take care of that. So again, I'm sorry, I cannot buy that as a legitimate reason not to expand this bill to give that some consideration at this time.
Senator Boucher, did you know?
Being one of the new kids on the block, Bill, was that funded last year? It passed the House and the Senate. Was it funded?
Left it out of the budget.
Yeah.
It was vetoed by the governor.
Yes, but there was
didn't
no
it originally start out at around $50,000, and then somebody decided, oh, we need $150,000 for this?
I don't recall. I believe it was somewhere under $50,000. Yeah, the actual salary was, I believe, $40,000 to $45,000. I said to me, was it?
There was
the total cost of the Board of Pharmacy may have been $135,000, but of that, some $40,000 to $45,000 was actual salary. That may not have included the additional employee benefits and state benefits, however. As I recall, and you've got a report there, I think you can look in that report to see what the board is costing now. On an average, boards and commissions, to my recollection, are costing between $40,000 and $60,000 based upon the travel and whatever support is assigned to them. I'm not sure in this case what that board is costing.
Representative Copeland.
Just a point on this, Representative Boucher's question. The fiscal note was passed along to the Finance Committee, but it was not included in the Division of Licensure's budget when it came out. The Finance Committee passed the bill along, but did not provide the money so that it was not in the budget as it finally came in the VRU.
So the governor, in effect, the main veto was that there was no fiscal note with it when it to his desk.
There may have been a fiscal note, there wasn't any money.
Okay.
That's correct. That is correct, that the governor...
I think Representative Furness is bringing probably one of the major problems that we have. The amount of cocaine coming into the state is just admirable. Not just admirable, we have to deal with it. But this is the message that I got from a longtime pharmacist today. He said, let's get this out and deal with that separately. And I talked about two or three of them. You indicate that you have the concern of the professional people on that board. And in fact, he said, I wish we had a teleconference so we could get that message to you. And I'll give you his name and number afterwards if you would care to contact him.
Well, I'm sure I have talked to him. Mr. Chairman, if I could make one last statement. The Board of Pharmacy is under pressure, and I can well appreciate that. If this body does not act upon the legislation, they are in essence in the sunset right now. They go out of business. So that is a source of their pressure. I think that's an unfair pressure placed upon these people. They respect the fact that they do need a board. So if you don't act, they go out of business. But the problem is still there. And I think it's within the wherewithal of this committee to address that effectively, and I believe this is the vehicle by which to do it. I cannot believe that anyone would terminate the Board of Pharmacy simply by virtue of you and your good conscience expanding this bill to do what ought to be done, and that is to address a very serious need in this state. So I think you can take a disadvantage and convert that into an opportunity to do something that's right. The Board of Pharmacies is needed. The exec director is needed. We have a problem. It's an avenue to deal with it. The problem is this committee prepared to step up to the issue and deal with it?
I think we have a very fine committee.
Well, I don't question the character of the committee, Mr. Chairman. I speak as a body. We as a legislative body must deal with this. This committee is a first committee of referral, and it is one that has at least the initial opportunity in order to deal with it. Time is of the essence, and I don't think you have much time to be delaying the action on it. I think there's considerable work already done on that, and I think if this committee opened up its mind and go out to teleconference or at least read through what these people are telling you, yes, they are concerned that the vote would be ultimately sunset. I don't think that's in the cards. I don't think the legislature or administration would support sunsetting this board. Now, if the problem was the fiscal note last time, the bill passed the House and Senate, well, then do it right this time. Pass it through the House, pass it through the Senate. Let's make sure that on a timely basis that all of the work is done, that the fiscal notes are intact, if that is indeed the problem. Now, that doesn't seem to be an insurmountable task to see the fiscal notes and that the authorization and the appropriation go hand in glove. It was a snafu, is my understanding, all that was done.
I think one of the questions was that the administration had was that they didn't want responsibilities overlapping, so that we had an executive secretary plus the administration, the department and the administration doing, in fact, the same thing. If that's not the case, then we probably should explore that, but it seems that would be something that the administration would have to relate to us. Ms. Representative Furness, did you have any...
Well, that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the patience of the committee for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Hanley, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did have some concern relayed to me. I haven't talked to a particular pharmacist, but a pharmacist in Anchorage who was very concerned with this particular bill. And she is on the Board of Pharmacy, and she indicated some concern, and I guess it was my impression that maybe she was going to be speaking by way of teleconference. I appreciate that we're looking at 120 days, but perhaps one of my frustrations is that you know, if we had the opportunity to hear the concerns, if most of these people are saying, please do pass this, you know, and hang on, I don't have any problem with that, but...
Representative Tanley, we have the chairman of that board. I'd like to hear his testimony,
right.
And if we have questions, then we will, I guess we could pursue the...
Okay.
I'm Jim McCorkle, Montgomery last week, chairman of the board of pharmacy. I'm talking about this bill that was passed last year, and the word that the pharmacist got anyway was that there was no fiscal note was the reason for the veto. And it was my understanding that representatives from the governor's office and from the board of pharmacy and from the leaders of the profession that the substitute bill would be brought in this session. And I had talked to the governor's office last week about it, and they said the bill was being drafted, and then when this bill finally came to be introduced, it's only one line. It certainly didn't take a week to draft that. Now, there's some misunderstanding somewhere. I don't know where it is. I wasn't on the committee that would have been doing the redrafting. But there were members of the pharmacy board, there was a member from the governor's office, and there were one or two members from the profession. Now, why it all boiled down to this only the extension, I don't know. That does happen to be the most important thing, because as of June 30th, we're out of business. And with the 120-day session, I don't know if you could get these other things that are needed into bill form and out. That's your job, not mine.
Thank you.
And that's basically we thought that this hearing today was going to be teleconference too, then, and that the pharmacists and concerned people around the state would be able to testify. And I'd be glad to answer any question or anything that I can.
Thank you. My intention is that there seems to be a lot of concern, and at least to hear the testimony from the other board members and some public input. So I will schedule a teleconference on this, and I will notify the committee members and yourself and others interested when that will be. Representative Davis?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you have any proposed language that we could include in this piece of legislation that you're interested in. Have you had any discussions with any legal people to provide that to the committee?
Not at this time. As I say, I don't know what the status of the public bill is.
Well, I think when you were told by people that there was no fiscal note, they probably meant there was just no money in the budget. It's probably what it was. Undoubtedly, there was a fiscal note to the legislation, but if they didn't say that, I think they probably meant that there was no money in the budget for this person to be put on staff. I think that's probably what they meant. It probably wasn't completely accurate to say there's no fiscal note. The accurate statement was there was no money in the budget for the position.
As it stands, I don't think that the pharmacy board has enough money to do the things that they're charged with now. taking on that controlled substances thing would be just beyond question.
Representative Boucher.
May I suggest that you convey that feeling in the teleconference, because that's not what the feeling that I'm getting, and I know so often in the profession there will be a different point of view on this thing, but it's an awesome burden to make you the first court of referral on the amount of cocaine that's coming into this state. Obviously, you move from just a board into a highly volatile position, and I suggest a lot of thought be given to this, especially since that no action on this could be sunsetting what I consider to be a very important board. In other words, don't get your act together on this. May I suggest it ahead of time, or first thing you know, we're going to be in a big drug battle on the thing. And I strongly recommend that you get that message out to all of them. And I agree with the chairman. I'd like to get the business before us out in front, but maybe we better discuss this on a teleconference.
Okay, Representative Davis.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate you providing the opportunity for the public to testify on this legislation. I'd just like to know for my benefit, in case I make some phone calls, when you think you might be scheduling this? Within a week or?
I would say probably not next week, but the following week sometime. That's when I'd like to try to.
I would, if I could just interject, I would like to see this scheduled as soon as possible so we can get this moving. It does go to Health and Social Services and on to Finance. In fact, whatever the board thinks on this, but I would think it would be more important to get this legislation moving, and could that additional language could go on in the next committee referral, although it's our duty to take care of this legislation or to see through it. And I'd like to hear more testimony, but I'm just getting concerned about it taking too long.
Okay, thank you. I will either reschedule next week's hearings or else have a meeting during one of the days when we don't meet next week teleconference, if that's agreeable with the members. And before we have any more comments, I'd just like to let you know that it is getting late. Carol Durfner from the governor's office wished to testify, so. Representative Pierce.
Thank you. I was just going to say that for expediency, perhaps we can have a joint teleconference with Hess, since it's going on to Hess. That way they will have heard the testimony and won't have to reinvent the wheel when it gets there.
It's a good idea. I'll ask the chairman.
You got all kinds of time, right?
We did that with asbestos. I wonder if we could do it with. We had joint hearing.
No reason, not true.
And then we'd all hear it at the same time, which might make a difference. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, I guess we'll discuss that and see if we can. That's a good idea. Thank you. I also have a letter here dated July 6, 1984, which says that the governor has directed the Department of Commerce and Economic Development and the Department of Law to review methods of better and more quickly implementing Alaska Statute 17.30 concerning controlled substances, and I'd just like to know what is being done to implement that, AS 1730.
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Law just passed out some regulations. Formulated and documented a form for the board's next meeting for approval, which is a registration form.
Did you put anything else in?
Basically, that's where we stand right now.
Okay.
We've got a lot of comments from other professions that are adverse to that registration form, so we're going to bring that whole situation before the Board of Commerce.
Okay. Could we receive a copy of that? Yeah. Could we receive a copy and kind of a little synopsis of a copy of the form and what is being done to implement that? I mean, you said you're going to the board. What, maybe we could get some ideas to a time frame.
Well, if we knew the, Mr. Chairman, if we knew the comments of the affected professional board, that would help us. And if we were going to craft the board, or in deciding not to craft the board.
Mr. Durfner.
Thank you.